Good evening. My name is Paul Holden-Graybund. I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. As you know, my goal here is simply to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, and if possible, to levitate. But before saying anything else, let me introduce to you Ambassador, and I hope I pronounce his name correctly, Carl Friis Matzen, who is presently the Consul General of Denmark in New York. Ambassador Friis Matzen would like to say a very few words about his countryman, René Redzepi.
Thank you very much, Paul. You did a great job pronouncing my name, except my first name, which is Jarl, but the rest of it was perfect. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here at the New York Public Library for an evening of tasting culture. Just 30 years ago, Copenhagen and the rest of Denmark had very few restaurants, and actually the food at those restaurants was really not worth eating. Today, Copenhagen has 12 restaurants with Michelin stars, and this is one of the highest per capita anywhere in the world. The top star among these restaurants is, of course, Noma and their chef, René Redzepi. I think that everyone who has had the pleasure of dining at Noma have their own little story to tell, and I have mine. It's a little bit private, but since I will only be sharing it with 300 people, I think it's okay. It was the day when my wife and I finally were to go to Noma after waiting for months, and we were really looking forward to this. And our youngest son, who is 9 years old, he was very preoccupied by the fact that we were going to what at the time was nominated as the world's third best restaurant. And we had although he's only 9 years old, a kind of philosophical discussion about whether you could, in fact, state whether a restaurant was number three in the world. And I said something like, well, Noma is undoubtedly one of the top restaurants in the world, but whether it's number one, it's number three, or it's number 10, it's difficult to say. Later that evening, after a 7-course lunch at Noma, the best and most extraordinary meal I have had in my whole life, and I've had many and many good meals, I had to go home and say something which is very difficult for me to say. Daddy made a mistake. I told him, Noma is not just the top three restaurant in the world, this is undoubtedly the best restaurant in the world. 7 months later, Noma received this acknowledgement by Restaurant Magazine at the San Pellegrino Awards. Denmark is, as you probably know, a small country with 5.5 million people. We have very few mega stars at the same time, but right now we have at least two. We have the world's second best tennis player, Caroline Wozniacki, and we have the best chef in the world, René Redzepi. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Friis Matzen. I won't dare pronounce your first name. I would like to quickly tell you about what's coming up on the live menu this season. You probably have seen our announcement. I ask you to refer to it. I asked our designer this year that I wanted to create a new kind of menu for the live season, and he took my words literally and created a menu. So, for instance, if you like martini, I suggest you come and hear Angela Davis and Toni Morrison. Tacos, Edwidge Danticat. Steak, of course, Lady Antonia Fraser. Eggs, David Grossman and Nicole Krauss. Wine, Zadie Smith. Cupcakes, Jay-Z. Bananas, Keith Richards. Now, speaking about Keith Richards, who will be coming to the library on the 29th of October, no tickets are not yet on sale. Keith Richards, I invited for one very simple reason. He said in his autobiography, which is coming out, that when he was a child, he wanted to be a librarian. Geste manqué, I think his life has had certainly has diverged from that path, but he did say that he wanted to become a librarian. He said that when he was growing up, two institutions mattered to him, the church, which belongs to God, and the library, which belongs to the people. The library, he said, is a great equalizer. Now, in that spirit, I would like to encourage all of you to become friends of the New York Public Library for just $40 a year, which is a pretty cheap date. You will get discounts on all live events. I would also like to announce that tonight's program is being telecast in real time, meaning I'm somewhere out there, by Fora TV, so anyone can be live for the conversation by tuning in online. To access a live stream, you simply go to HTTP and then :// and Fora.tv. Tonight we have the pleasure of welcoming back to the live from the New York Public Library stage, Ruth Reichel, who will instigate a conversation between René Redzepi, whose restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, as you heard, was voted the best restaurant in the world after Ferran Adrià, who was on this stage a couple of years ago, was bestowed with that same honor for El Bulli. And I believe René Redzepi actually worked for Ferran Adrià. Ruth Reichel was the editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine for 10 years. She's the editor of the Modern Library Food Series. Her books include Festiary, Comfort Me with Apples, Tender at the Bone, For You, Mom, finally, originally published as Not Becoming My Mother and Other Things She Taught Me Along the Way. David Chang is the executive chef and owner of Momofuku Noodle Bar, Momofuku Co., Momofuku Milk Bar, Sam Bar, and chef and co-owner of Mapesh. Chang has taken home 3 James Beard Foundation Awards. Samba was named one of the 50 best restaurants in the world by Restaurant Magazine. His most recent book is Momofuku. They will all sign their books after this event. René Redzepi is head and owner of Noma Restaurant in Copenhagen. Noma was named the #1 world's best restaurant in the world at the San Pellegrino World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards. He is widely credited with reinventing Nordic cuisine at Noma, which is set in a shipping warehouse from the 18th century. He creates inventive takes on Nordic cuisine with a distinctive emphasis on regional specialties. At the age of 32, one of them is 32, the other one is 33, it annoys me greatly, Redzepi is one of the most influential chefs in the world. His first major cookbook, which he will sign tonight, thanks to Feiden and to our independent bookstore, 192 Books, you get the book there, they're signed over there, is Noma, Time and Place in Nordic Cuisine. Before the signing, there will be time for a Q&A, a question I have calculated. You've heard me say this many times. It's about 52 seconds long, and a good question is about 47 seconds long. 2 years ago, nearly to the day, on October 10th, 2008, on the live from the New York Public Library stage, we welcomed Ferran Adrià. In 2008, El Bulli was voted restaurant #1 in the world. Flash Rosenberg, our live from the New York Public Library artist in residence, drew the conversation. She will very quickly now introduce a clip you will see. Then we will swiftly move from the pleasures of El Bulli to those of Noma. Flash.
Thank you very much, Paul, for the opportunity to be artist in residence for Live from the New York Public Library. What I do is I set up at a table that's kind of lit there in the back, you can see it, to draw the speakers' conversations live in real time during the events. My quick sketches are then videotaped, edited, and they create then a summary of the program's ideas and comments. What I do in drawing is sort of like this bread that I baked this morning. Imagine each ingredient as a concept. I took the boldness of fresh beets, the attitude of dill, the argument of onion, in conversation with organic whole wheat and a bunch of other ingredients, to create this overall impression that's a dialogue of the ingredients, which I call beet poet bread. It is shaped as either a baguette or a little mini loaf to represent how each person shapes how they hear in different ways. And when you slice it open, it's not what you expect. It's pink and savory. And since tonight's focus is on food, as Paul said, it seemed appropriate to now show you a finished one of these discussions called, it's a conversation portrait with Ferran Adria, Harold McGee, and Corby Kummer. Thank you.
Introduce Corby Kummer, Harold McGee, and Maestro Ferran Adria, Bill Buford.
I think there's two ways to approach Ferran Adria, as a god and as a mortal. As a god, he's the person that Alain Ducasse described the greatest chef on the planet. As a mortal, he's just a guy in the kitchen. But first, I wanted to make a few random observations about my first meal at El Bulli. The meat course was course 35, and it consisted of three baby pigtails, beautifully crisp, beautifully fried on the side of the plate. Sweet things like chocolate were savory, savory things like beets were sweet, and everything was all confused until we got a Szechuan button, which electrified our tongues, and we were all utterly in this man's power. Tonight, Ferran Adria is going to be questioned and interrogated by two of our most formidable writers of food. Corby Kummer, who's a great advocate of slow food, and Harold McGee, who is the smartest man on food alive. McGee, it is my privilege to introduce possibly the greatest chef ever, Ferran Adria, God.
Del taller todo el mundo habla y casi es decir en el del bulli mucha gente habla y no ha estado casi nadie.
A lot of people talk about the bulli, but very few people have actually been.
Del taller del bulli hay un mito bastante equivocado.
As far as the taller, the workshop, there's a bigger myth.
La gente igual se puede imaginar que hay probetas y cosas allá aparatos raros.
People may think it's like a proper science lab, you know, with testing tubes and the likes.
Para nada.
And it's not at all like that.
Hay cocineros.
There are chefs, cooks.
Cuchillos.
Knives.
Y mucha, mucha pasión por la creatividad.
And with a very great passion for creativity.
¿Y cómo empezamos?
So where do we start? How do we do it?
Empezamos una silla, una mesa.
Started off with just a table and a chair.
Y 20 libros.
And 20 books.
You stopped serving bread because you said that anyone can get bread any place else in the world. They have to come here for what only I can give them.
No, yo me doy cuenta un momento en mi trayectoria.
I realized at a very certain moment in my career
que hay algo que no funciona en los restaurantes.
That something wasn't working in restaurants.
Sobre todo en restaurantes de cocina de vanguardia, de cocina
especially avant-garde restaurants.
Cuando si ahora voy a casa de Harold.
If I go to Harold's home.
No tengo carta, no hay una carta allí.
I don't get a menu.
No, me sentaré en la mesa.
I'll sit at his table.
Harold me hará la cocina que él quiera.
And Harold will cook whatever he pleases.
No hay una carta donde pueda decir, Harold, por favor, ¿me puedes traer una ensalada de tal?
I can't ask Harold, hey, can I get this salad?
¿Cómo es posible que en un restaurante de cocina vanguardia pueda haber una carta?
So I thought, oh, how is it possible that an avant-garde restaurant should have a menu?
But you know, it was 35 dishes and there's no menu. Because the whole idea is you're constantly surprised, you're constantly taken off balance. And there would be no point in having a menu because it's all new experiences you've never had before.
But the first thing that hits you is just how beautiful the dishes are. And then they're delicious. There were dishes that I was puzzled by. I really had no idea how they were done. The second time I ate there, I actually ate at the kitchen table, and Ferran was there to explain how things were done, if we wanted to know. The one that came to my mind is actually something that was very simple, but completely inexplicable, and that was a cup of coconut. Tasted like the most intense coconut I've ever had. When you're presented with something on the plate, you don't say, oh man, that must have been done in a vacuum dehydrator. How interesting. It's, that's the best piece of coconut I've ever had in my life. Well, cooks are now pushing the limits of what they do and know so much that they're actually creating new areas for scientists to work in because we don't really know what's going on when, for example, you cook an egg at 63 degrees Celsius for 24 hours. Scientists can't tell you what the proteins are doing to give you the kind of creamy texture that you get in the white. Sous vide cooking, that involves cooking meat for maybe 2 or 3 days at relatively low temperatures, but it has a texture like nothing you've ever had before.
Which is the goal, to make people experience food in a way they haven't before. But Ferran, do you want people to know what they're eating?
Saber de comer Es muy difícil.
To know about food and eating is a rather difficult task.
Muy difícil.
A really difficult one.
Imposible.
Impossible.
¿Cuántos tipos de zanahoria hay en el mundo?
How many different types of carrots are there?
Multiplica esto por todos los productos que hay en el mundo.
Multiply that by all the different ingredients available in the world.
Te darás cuenta que no puedes saber.
And you realize you don't, you just can't know, you won't have the knowledge.
Es muy difícil entender una comida en el bulli.
And it's rather difficult to understand a meal at the bulli.
Como es muy difícil entender un amanecer.
Like it's very difficult to understand a sunrise.
No se entiende.
You don't understand.
Lo disfrutas y ya está.
You just enjoy it.
Tell us something you've eaten in New York that you were interested in.
Hoy hemos ido a, ¿cómo se llama? El Calf, ¿no? José Andrés. Calf.
Oh, yes, we went to Katz Delicatessen this morning.
It's clear to me how driven Ferran's cooking is, not by science, but by the need to make new things, and also by the need to understand how those things are made and to understand the process by which they're made.
Nosotros no soñábamos en nuestra vida.
Because we never expected
crear lo que hemos creado.
To create what we have ended up creating.
No, al final yo, la gente come lo que a mí me gusta comer.
In the end, people eat what I like eating.
Es algo tan sencillo como esto.
It's as simple as that.
After Ferran Adrià, please welcome to this stage René Redzepi, Ruth Reichel, and David Chang.
Okay, I think after watching that, we have to begin by, I mean, it seems to me that you're doing almost the opposite of what Ferran is doing. I mean, when he says that you can't understand food, it seems to me that what you're trying to do is make people understand food. That you come at this from a very different place.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm trying to understand food myself, first of all. That's where the starting point is. Understanding the process of how to cook the carrot, what happens, that has been explored a lot. For me, what's very interesting is still, of course, to explore how the carrot is cooked and what happens in the process once the water is boiling and so on. But in fact, what is a carrot? Why is the carrot in our part of the world? What seeds belong in our part of the world? And how are they grown best? And where does the carrot originate from? And what is a carrot, you know? Is it the true carrot we're eating? Or is a carrot meant to be something else? Okay. That's how what our job is a big part of.
Okay, maybe we should play, David, we should play number four. So since you've brought up
okay.
Carrot.
Yeah. I'm just gonna stand up.
Not this one.
Can we stop that? It's called the vintage carrot.
Yeah, it's number four. Yes.
There we go. So, okay, we'll see here. This is a farm. This is chamomile. There grows two types of chamomile there. This is that one we use to make tea. Then the one on the bottom we'll cook with. I'll explain about the vintage carrot because it actually is a vintage carrot. It's an old carrot. We'll just talk you through the dish. Afterwards, I'll explain to you about the carrot, the vintage carrot. We cook it in goat's butter for a long time. We add chamomile to the pan. It infuses beautifully. The sweetness of a carrot with the sweetness of chamomile is just fantastic together. And this particular type of chamomile, the small buds or heads there of the carrot or the chamomile is fantastic to eat as well. Please notice the meat there of the carrot, how the leathery texture of the outside. I'll explain more about it. This is sorrel leaves. The best part of the sorrel leaf is the stem. I think usually probably that's what you throw out. It's a very, very simple dish somehow of cooked carrots with these sorrel stems and different types of wild sorrel leaves. The juice or the sauce is just simply juiced sorrel with a touch of rapeseed oil. So, the vintage carrots. We had an extremely, extremely cold winter in Denmark this year. Beyond belief, the water was frozen outside our outside our restaurant. I've never tried it before. And since we are a restaurant that focuses on ingredients that surround us, we, of course, were having problems in February. And also in March, the winter was stretching. And we were having so much trouble that we were actually thinking that we were going to have to import ingredients to have enough diversity to actually cook for our guests. It was a major crisis that we had. So, but we still wanted to keep the work within our frame, which is the Nordic. We work with the ingredients that surround us. That's it. So, we went to one of our farmers. We asked him, "What do you have? Just give us whatever. We'll look at it." What happened is that he had put carrots onto the field. They were supposed to be harvested in summer. He left them there. Nobody bought them. It was a new variety. As you saw, it was a blue carrot. And then he left them. They wintered in the soil. Next spring, he left the field to rest. Then when autumn came, he plowed the field, took the carrots up, and then he put them in his storage room just for no reason. He didn't even think about it. And then we were in his farm, in his cold room, with these carrots, utterly old, shitty, horrible carrots when eaten raw, mealy, starchy. You would just throw them away normally. But we were, of course, desperate. So what we did is that we thought to ourselves, how is it that you cook a piece of meat? You know, if the chefs are there, you know, when we take a piece of meat, it's expensive and our animal has to die for it. So you treat it with respect. You cook it on a pan. It has the right temperature. It's also the right pan. It's a good pan. And you twist it and turn it and you spice it. You add herbs and you nurture it and you nurture it and you baste it and you put butter and you nurture it again and you twist and you turn and you take so good care of it so that this piece of meat can be exactly as perfect as possible. So we said to ourselves, why don't we try to do that with the carrot, with this horrible, shitty carrot? We'll try to treat it with the same amount of respect. This video here is taken when spring came, so we used chamomile. But it started as a dish where we took the carrot and we put it on a pan with goat's butter, and we twisted, and we turned, and we nurtured, and we basted, and we had herbs, and we had spices. And it took almost 2 hours to cook this carrot of this size here. Slow heat, twisting, turning, nurturing. Transformation, like magic. This starchy, shitty carrot melts together and becomes, as you saw there, almost meaty in its texture, with the leathery outside that has so rich in caramelized flavors, and the sweetness was just beyond belief. So, of course, as a chef, this is a revelation, that here we are thinking that we have to eat as fresh products as possible, and we're eating a carrot that's a year and a half old, you know? This was really like a complete surprise for me. And because I am the way I am, I start thinking, well, what is a carrot really? What if this, the shitty thing that we thought it was, what if that is a carrot? What if this is the true carrot? Who knows? Nobody knows about these things anymore. We just think that they are the way they are because that's how we get them. And I tracked the carrot. The last country I tracked the carrot down to originate from was Afghanistan. And imagine what happened since it just left Afghanistan and it came to Denmark and ended in our kitchen. Maybe we were close to the original carrot from Afghanistan. So we asked our farmer, what else do you have of old, shitty vegetables? Because it was still winter, and this is just one dish, you know. People come and they want more. They want a lot to eat. Vintage potatoes. And that's even better. Vintage potatoes is the same thing. But what happens here is that on the second year of this potato's life, it starts to shoot. You have the mother potato and the small shoots come of it. Very small potatoes, the size of a hazelnut forms, and that lives off the nourishment of the mother potato, resulting in a potato that's, again, just beyond belief. Not starchy, more, in fact, texture as a carrot, and needs to cook very little. You know, that one actually needs texture when you cook it, because it doesn't taste raw just when it gets a little bit of heat. It has all the wonderful and beautiful nutty flavors that a very good potato can have.
I mean, the thing that's so interesting, have you ever tried the limitation? I mean, you know, here in New York, we have everything available to us, right? I mean, what you've
smog,
done is...
Paris.
We don't have everything. But that's what I'm always amazed that Renee does, and I think it's one of the strengths of Noma. It's putting a limitation on what you cook and reanalyzing and reevaluating things like a carrot or a potato. They put a creative ceiling on what you can do, and it forces you to sort of work with what you have and making the best of that. And I think that in New York, we do have everything, and sometimes we get carried away when we lose some focus.
I mean, can you imagine a New York cuisine that was like a Noma cuisine?
Well, that's what I hope for, is that we're going to create an American cuisine, because Renee's done it in a very short period of time. He's put, you know, people want to say New Scandinavian. I just say he's interpreting, you know, Copenhagen, Denmark, you know, his crew, what they do. It's in their food, and it's in a very short period of time, he's created a food culture, which is something that I'm always struggling to identify. What is New York food culture? What is American food culture? And, you know, the guys at Noma have done it in 7 years.
So, I mean, when you set out, I mean, did you think about what is a restaurant? I mean, when you thought about what Noma was?
Yes, I did. I mean, even though I was young, at that point, when we were opening a restaurant in 2003, I had already become tired, this is my own personal opinion, of the what I call the act of restaurants, where I, as a diner and probably the server, they together join an act of 3 to 4 hours where everybody pretends that they're part of a different social layer than they're not really. The waiter is very, and the diner is the same time, you know, you're sitting to next to each other and being formal, and because this is what great food has to be surrounded by. So we wanted to have a place that signaled some rawness to it, without tablecloths, stripped away from you know. It should feel without pretense that when you came into our restaurant, you should feel that the emphasis was on the ingredients and the people. That was most important, not on the so-called luxury that somehow had to be there in order for it to be great food.
Because I mean, one of the things when I tried to think about what I mean, because your cuisine. I mean, you're really good friends, but you serve very different kinds of food from each other. But you're both kind of reevaluating what the relationship between the customer and the kitchen is.
Very much, and I mean, I think it was by accident, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if all of you guys have been to Noma, but if you do go eat there, the cook serves you the food, and oftentimes the cook that's serving you the food also picked the herbs, picked the vegetable, and prepped it all out, and he's also cooking in it and then serving it to you. So it's a, you know, it's this whole experience that makes Noma that special, and you know, you're seeing that popping up, you know, a few places. But I think I was asking Soren or one of your sous chefs how that happened, and you're like running the pass, and you're just like, just get it out there, serve the food, and
yeah,
that sort of became the...
It started in that way, just, you know, get the food out. We're all a part of a big team. I wanted to break these barriers that usually are in restaurants where where there's really two teams within the team, and it's difficult to get these people somehow sometimes to work as a unit together. So it was a way of initially just saying, okay, we're together on this. You know, what is it that we want? Why are we here? It's to make people happy. And let's just make people happy, all of us, and just serve the food while it's ready. Don't stand there and shout on waiters, because they're probably not lazy. They're just a little bit busy. What has been so interesting in this whole period of looking at the chefs while they are serving food and seeing what happens to people, it's just extraordinary. Because I think what I found out was that a lot of chefs, they are so trained in following a format. They follow the recipe, and that's it. You know, let's say there's a watercress sauce, and there's a recipe for it. And the recipe demands 200 grams of this and that and whatever. And they follow that, period, full stop. What if it rains the day before? All the chefs know that if it rains a lot, then the watercress tastes more of water. So therefore, the recipe doesn't function anymore. It was incredible to see when they start interacting with the guest, when they ultimately had the feeling of giving food, and at the same time we also put chefs in nature, picking their own foods, harvesting it, seeing how it grows, following it week by week, going back to the kitchen, picking it, cooking it, and then serving it, giving it to the guests themselves, which for me is the essence of a restaurant, is actually that you're giving to people. It created a whole new level of commitment and a level of awareness on how they cook, because they're looking people in the eyes and they're giving it to them. So they go back and they taste, you know. They don't just tell themselves, well, it's a recipe, it's all right. You know, they're tasting, they're taking stronger standpoints to how they're cooking. And that was, you know, a very pleasant surprise that the whole kitchen changed like that. And I would say that is very much the essence of our place. It's because we have this team that where everybody is so committed, and they are every day taking so strong standpoints on what they're doing constantly.
What made you decide that what you wanted to do was this kind of very rigorous, difficult to do, locally based cuisine? I mean, you didn't come at you'd worked with Adria, you'd worked with Keller.
Well, yeah, and a lot of these journeys actually was a big push in the right direction. Going to Ferran Andreas, we just saw him; he's incredibly inspiring. When I went there, this was in '98. Before where I worked, the whole world was French cuisine, for obvious reasons. I would like to say before I continue that I love French cuisine. I love it. When you hear me say anything, you're not hearing me talk against it, because more or less any cuisine has a foundation of crème in them. But I thought I was going to travel the world, go back to Denmark, and do my version of French cuisine. And suddenly I found myself, after being working at a three-star in France, going to Spain and just seeing a whole new way of thinking, which was just so liberating. I left that place with a big sense of freedom.
And freedom to do something completely different.
Freedom to think, well, maybe it's not the absolute truth, French cuisine. Maybe there's other ways of approaching it. I was, of course, you know, I was 19, 20 years old. And then another lucky shot was that Grant Achatz, he was at El Bulli that year. And he brought the book of the French Laundry. And I remember clearly when I reading the book of the French Laundry, that back then I didn't know anything about America. Well, I've seen movies, of course, like anybody. You watch the movies and Terminator and all these things. But what I knew about the eating culture and what people eat was what was available in Denmark. And what is that? That's McDonald's and Burger King, you know, big corporations that are poisoning planet Earth. If you heard about anything, you heard about great friendships going to America. So here I was reading this book, and an American chef incorporating some type of pop culture, the coffee and donuts, the macaroni and cheese, embracing what many people just made fun of. And I thought it was so inspiring to see that I went there. I just told Grant, please, Grant, can you get me in there? And he got me in, and then he left.
Okay, I think we should open.
I think that's a good idea.
Open the bag here. So you all have a little goodie bag here. Here.
Yep. Thank you.
So
I left mine.
I don't need
we'll
a goodie bag. Here, we can share.
One more here. So, here. Yep.
Okay. So tell us that you got these ingredients, right?
Well, we have had a few people, I guess vice versa, but we've had a few of our cooks and sous chefs go to Noma, and they come back, and one of our chefs at Sambar came back from Noma, and he was just like, David, I need to get a forager, and he developed this relationship, and we have a few of Renee's ex-cooks at Momofuku, and they, Daniel Burns and company, they created this beautiful bag of local vegetables and herbs and sea vegetables from Maine and Vermont. You have a couple types of sea asparagus, radishes from New York.
Mention this one. Get the green one out, everybody.
Get your green one.
Get the green one out, because this is just a perfect example of what has happened at Noma for so many years, and so many times I've just been surprised. You want to tell them what it is?
Mm. It's a type of kiwi.
It's a wild kiwi from Maine.
Oh, it's so delicious.
Can you believe that?
It's so delicious.
And, you know, when I went to Copenhagen, and I was fortunate enough to just walk around. If you walk around with Renee anywhere, he's going to start picking stuff out of the ground. And he did. You know, we were in the park, and he starts picking stuff. But when we went to, you know, that's the thing. It's discovery of stuff that you would normally just pass by, like the bulrush, which I had never had before, and I tasted it, and it was like a cucumber hearts of palm. And I was like, how did I never have this before? And it's just sitting in your backyard, and nobody knows. And that was sort of the curiosity that I think the team at Noma has, is no stone is going to be left unturned.
Yeah. Mm.
So do you see, I mean, foraging is this thing that, I mean, when Jean-Georges opened, he had a forager and he said he was going to be foraging ingredients, and that sort of vanished. Has its time come in America?
I think...
Not too bad, not too bad.
It's never gone away. It's always been around. I mean, we just don't have it readily available. And I think that... I know there's spots of forage in Central Park, but I think people would freak out if we were in whites and trying to get the morels where I know they are and stuff like that. But, you know, there's some beautiful stuff in Maine.
Why not forage in Central Park? Why not? I mean, it's there, it's edible, and if you can have foraging trips in Central Park...
There are foraging trips.
There is? Great.
Yeah, we used to forage in Prospect Park for gourmet.
I would like to comment on this, the whole foraging notion. And for me, the idea of foraging is bigger than just the word, let's go forage. It's about going back to nature. You know, understanding what is out there, seeing the big diversity. If you go to a supermarket, or even if you call your supplier, David, there's a list of ingredients to choose from, which, I don't know, maybe there's 40, maybe there's 50. If there's a lot of ingredients to choose from, then you have 70, 80, various greens and so on. If you look at any book about wild foods, there's thousands to choose from. So we have a diversity out there that is just ready to be used and to and and to get reconnected with, and also in that way, I think you'll have a bigger diversity on the different menu cards around the world, which we have to agree on, or we have to just perhaps not agree, and we just have to. I feel that increasingly, menu cards are the same all over the world. If you close your eyes and you eat in Sydney, even in New York, in London or some places, you don't know where you are anymore. There's lacking somehow a sense of a connection to its place, which I think is a shame. And I believe that going a step back and reconnecting with nature is a good starting point, at least.
So, how do you feel about eating insects? Do you serve insects at NOMA?
If there was insects that were that I knew I could get and they tasted delicious, I would serve it. Of course, I would.
Well, he serves live shrimp right now.
Still? Yeah. We have live shrimps. I mean, that's just as ugly
we should look at the sea.
Okay, that's a good idea. We have some videos.
The sea one is number 3.
Yeah, this is for you to kind of understand how we work when it comes to creativity. So it's called the sea. This is just because I didn't know what to call it. it might as well be called the shrimp. Water, sea. Beach plants. These grows in the sand. I don't know if you noticed this before, but you can even see it on the ground there, that there's a lot of seaweed flushed in. This is perfect growing conditions. So much nutrients, and what shoots up there is just some of the most incredible ingredients. That this one, I can't remember the name of this, but this is the ingredient that the Vikings used to eat to survive so that they can crusade over to England and plunder and rape. So look at the variety. This is beach peas, for instance. Here we have 12 varieties of beach plants, each of them very significant and unique in their own respect. And there's a beach mustard in front of you with a very strong flavor to it. We have taken the beach rocks and beach water, and we kind of just put the plants back. The sea that you looked at was, there's two types of shrimp. This is a more deep sea shrimp. This is a vinaigrette of just very basically cream, low-fat cream, and dill oil. It works with the creaminess of this of the shrimp. And then there's early season urchin, which we take everything out of it, and then we freeze it, and we grate it. And there you have a big taste of the sea. I think, can we go to the oyster, which is number...
Oyster is number, 2.
Number 2. Because there's another example of this one's called steam oyster. There's another part of Denmark. You see it's very low water or low tide there. There's different plants growing right there. Which you see all the seaweed here that's just been flushed in. It's perfect conditions for all these plants to come up. Again, it's a type of beach pea. It's very sweet. This is beach cabbage, a type of wild cabbage. This one is one of the... Can you pause for a second here?
Is that the sea coriander?
Yeah. This plant is one of the first times where I thought, well, we're onto something. There is... That when I tasted this, we went and took a trip on the beach, like we do, and you saw this plant. Once you start being a lot in nature, you start to be able to see what looks edible and what's not. And this one was thick and juicy, looked succulent, but also had an appearance of a chive.
Looks so, like grass.
It looks awesome. Oh, okay.
Look like a lawn to me.
For the untrained eye. You tried it, you remember. And I remember picking this and the juices start oozing out of it and putting it in my mouth and tasting it. It has a perfect crack to it. you know, nice texture, lots of juice, and then it comes. Such a mild and elegant flavor of coriander, which is, for me, was just extraordinary. Here I was in the cold north, and suddenly you have a flavor of coriander, something you've always expected to belong to somewhere else, certainly not in the north.
So did it taste like coriander leaves, like cilantro? Or
like cilantro. No. It was
like the juice, and it's just very pure and clean. And it was just, when I tasted it, I was like, there is no way. This I'm eating like a lawn. I really thought it was. And it tastes like a nectar of coriander or something. It was just beautiful.
Yeah. It's here as well. We found it here. Chang found it here. In his search for grass, the edible stuff, that is. The other stuff is easy to find. It's just such a surprise when you're there and you're eating coriander. All your life you've been thinking it belongs somewhere else and it's an exotic plant. And then by just research and going there and talking to people and trying, you find something that was just unusual, and you start thinking to yourself, well, maybe there's just so much more out there than we understand. Can we continue again with the oyster? This is a dish of these beach plants again. It's a native oyster, quite large. It's 8 years old. We line a pot with beach rocks and seawater again, sea plants and seaweeds and so on. Old shells, and then a touch of horseradish, one of the cornerstones of Scandinavian cuisine, along with rye bread. Pickled, these are unripe pickled elderberries. That is fantastic and gives a flowery taste to it. And these are, of course, things that we do a lot. We have a room, a huge room that's filled with preserves and salted things and dried things. For winter, that's one of them. We line the beach plants on there, and then we close it up. We put it back into, let's say, its environment, into the pot with the beach plants and the seaweeds and the rocks and the seawater. And then 4 minutes later, you have a dish, a perfect dish that's served like that in front of the guest, and the hot seawater just brings a flavor of the sea and a smell of the sea to the whole restaurant. Mm. And another perfect example on your inspiration can be found very, very, very close by. If you search, you don't have, always to look so many places. Should we take one more now that we're at it?
Oh, sure. Why
sure.
Not? The hen and the egg?
Let's take the hen and the egg, yeah.
That's one.
That's number one.
Or do you want to do asparagus and spruce?
Let's take the asparagus and spruce.
Five.
Number five.
So how did you figure out what was that? How did you learn about foraging?
Hold on. Just let me explain this. So I don't know if you just noticed, there was an asparagus field. Did you notice what was just next to it? There was a spruce. There you go, the spruce. Right next to it, spruce grows, and that became the dish. We were there, we're talking to a farmer. He tasted a beautiful white asparagus this year, and the spruce was right there. So we harvested the asparagus. The green ones we grill. Once they've been grilled and heated through, we juice them, and the end result is something again magical, vegetable sauce that is just beyond belief, and so pure and intense. We take the asparagus that grows right next to the spruce and tie them onto the branches. And then we grill them like that. What happens is that the resin and the essential oils of this spruce incorporates and infuses into the asparagus. And that citrus tone, almost eucalyptus-y note there is to that, is for me perfect to this sweet asparagus. We do also pick the tips of the spruce, which is delicious. I found out that you could eat them by looking at the animals. in spring. They were so, you know, eating all the tips. There you go, the tips is there. And then there's a sauce of the green asparagus with a bit of spruce oil to it. And then we add a dot of whipped cream to go with it. Yeah. Looks pretty good, huh?
I just wanted to add, like, yes, it's foraging and it's all this stuff, but I think what separates Noma from a lot of restaurants is it's all about execution, and there's so much discipline, and the cooks, there's camaraderie that I've rarely seen, and an integrity level that, you know, I try to get our guys to emulate. And, you know, we recently had a cook come back from a stage, and he came back and he was like reborn. What makes the food at Noma even better than it should be is because there's so much care. There's tenacity in the kitchen to just make it really good. Okay. And I think that you just don't find that often. It's a very rare trait, I think.
But now, how do you make this pay? I mean, you have, what, two cooks for every seat?
Well, yeah. I just forgot about that.
I mean, that kind of dedication,
of course,
costs money.
It costs money, and that's why it is expensive. And on the notion of the book, in fact, one of the most regrettable things for me personally, running this so-called fine dining restaurant, is that it's not reaching out to enough people, because you have to be able to afford it. You know, that's why I think actually a book can be a great thing to kind of showcase a little bit for an affordable price. But you're right. How do you make this happen? There's no way around it. You're just going to have a lot of hands, especially if you are out there taking ingredients yourself and washing them. They don't come home in a package where they're pre-washed and cut perfectly. Everything is yourself. It's very time-consuming, much more than it is to slice a piece of salmon into 10 portions, for instance. It's much more time-consuming to do 10 portions of the shitty carrot, for instance. Mm. It truly is, and there is a thing there that I'm not too sure how many people understand how extreme and passionate chefs are for their trade, and how much commitment there is to it. I mean, today, these packages here, I was completely surprised. I asked David Chang to help, and I go and I check out in the kitchen, and there are 6 guys packing this for you. And just because they want to learn, they want to experience. And yesterday I was in San Francisco and in Seattle, and the journalist says to me, "But why do you work for free?" You know, it was complete, just a wrong notion for him. And that is chefs, you know, they are just so passionate. And I don't think that great restaurants would exist if they weren't for these people. Because if they were to just keep it very squared, it would be so expensive to dine out, and we wouldn't have the level that we do. Chefs are natural-born martyrs.
It's true. It's true. You do not
do
this if you want to make a lot of
money. They would be the best terrorist in the world.
Now, there's a good line. You'll hear that quoted, I'm sure. But, you know, one of the things that I appreciate so much about what you've done, David, is that you actually figured out a way to make cuisine that is daring and challenging and affordable for people. I mean, do you ever think about trying to do something that is, I don't know, a food cart of some kind, Renee's food
well,
cart?
I mean, I wish that I had the brains to do it. I don't think I have. And it's difficult. And what I think David Chang has done is just a revolution in that sense. Because I think that, that you know, food that's affordable and that's also so fucking delicious. Sorry to say it. We use bad language here. You know, it's very, 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 very difficult. And you have to have the right set of brains to do
it. And it's a real respect for the audience. I mean, it's something that people don't do very much at an affordable price, which is say, you know, I trust you that you'll trust me, and to really try doing things that aren't easily gettable. You know?
Just trying to make tasty food.
Yeah. Come on,
you know, it's a team. It's team effort. Team effort, and right place, right time.
But you know, it's great that you send people off to. Where else do you send your people off to stage?
You know. Obviously, it's because of Noma hitting number one, it seems to be, David, do you think you can get me a stage at Noma? But I think having spent time in that kitchen, I just think it's a great training ground for young cooks to have respect for the profession and to learn integrity. And camaraderie, and to not, and teamwork is to not let someone else down. And I mean, that's why I love sending cooks there, because they come back and they have this sense of, I'm not going to let you down. I'm not going to burn this. I'm not going to burn this 2-year-old carrot. You know why? Because it wouldn't age 2 years, even if it tastes shitty. Somebody picked it. I had to go to the farm today. You know, there's a sense of ownership that I think that. Is really something that we're trying to cultivate. I know a lot of restaurants are trying to cultivate here in America, but we don't have the resources. This is not an excuse. It's just I didn't know that Copenhagen had the abundance of natural resources. It's amazing. 30 minutes away, you're on the beach. 30 minutes away, you're in Dragsholm, this massive field that's been, you know, dried out, and you have every type of herb and wild, everything that's delicious, and we just don't have that.
Are you sure about that?
I'm not sure.
We don't have a field of asparagus where, you know, the water's been, you know, dried out, and you have a bed of seashells, and the mineral content makes the vegetables that much better. We just don't have that on the East Coast. So it's a special place, Copenhagen itself. So
I would like to comment us now that we're talking you sending stages to Noma. One thing that is just also incredible to watch with people that haven't tried it before is when people come, they have a training. They are so-called chefs or cooks. They have gone to school, and they are now cooks. So, and you know, they know how to make the béarnaise. And the this and the that and blah, 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 according to whatever school they walk and what repertoire they have. And, you know, there's a certain amount of excitement when people see new dishes or they see a new way of doing a sauce. But nothing, and this is really, really true, nothing beats the excitement of seeing a chef the first time on his knees picking some little herb somewhere in nature. There is just something that is so buried in us, I believe, that, you know, even the toughest New York chef like David Chang was on his knees and harvesting and pushing all the other chefs away because it was his herb that he was going to cook with.
I wanted to sabotage everybody. Yes.
And I think it's just so magical to notice that moment when people realize it and they get that the moment that connection happens. And I think once you have it, you have it, you know, it's there for your life.
Now, does that feeling translate for, I mean, there's something almost mystical about the idea that this food is it's not something that's been cultivated by man, that it's out there, it's a gift. Nature just gives it. I mean, can you translate that feeling for the people who are eating it?
It's very meta.
I don't know if I can translate it. Well, I think that somehow, of course, the way that you cook, the way that things are cooked, somehow can represent it and be maybe it's a small translation of it. I think that if you are out there, a lot of people would say that, I hear this all the time, that our dishes, they are so landscapey and they look like a forest or a shoreline or something like that. And it's not intentionally that it happens like this. This is because this is where we are. This is how we work. This is our everyday life, and it just becomes like that. So I guess that is a translation of it somehow.
And it just seems to me that the cooking is a gift, but you're also doing something that's sort of this gift from nature. There's something wonderful. So I just want to go back to, how did you learn to forage?
Well,
because I'm sure we all now want to go out and forage. How do we train ourselves?
Get your inner savager forward. Of course, don't ever chance it with mushrooms. Lesson number one.
I did one.
Not those mushrooms, Cheng.
In Finland, I didn't listen to anybody, and I immediately ate a mushroom off the table, and the forager was like, "That's a poisonous mushroom."
But you're still here.
Well, there's mushrooms that can kill you. There's mushrooms that can make you impotent, and there's mushrooms that can that can choke you for a little while. But mushrooms is dangerous stuff. Okay, take it easy with the mushrooms. But I'm sure all you New Yorkers have foraged for mushrooms before. There was a lot of reading. There was a lot of going back in time, looking at old books and trying to find people that knew about what was out there. And this was very, very, very difficult, in fact. I mean, I could find, signature books of great chefs and cuisines from around the world, read books about that, but in fact, finding out what was out there of ingredients that were our own was very difficult. And today, of course, things have changed, but in the beginning, it was a huge problem. And simply, it started by reading books and looking at who wrote this book, trying to track this person down and starting a conversation with this person and asking about ingredients and making them work for you and making them become part of the team and harvesting for you and teaching them. Along the way, we have met historians that we work with, biologists that we work with. That's a part of the team, a part of the email correspondence that goes on all the time when we see a new or we read a new about a new ingredient. And that's what's so great about, for instance, modern technology. You can be somewhere in a forest and you take a picture and you email it, and 2 minutes later, you get a... This is great. It's really, foraging with an iPhone, you find a spot where there's great wild horseradish, and you put a how do you say that in English? The mark on the map.
Oh, I don't.
The pin. You put a pin on
drop
there.
Drop the pin.
Yeah, you put a pin on there, and you instantly email it out to all the kitchen. And then it's there, it's just incredible. So ancient ways with new technology has just been quite useful. And I would say that there's no way around it. You simply have to read.
Okay. I thought we would take some questions.
Should we look at the last dish?
You want to
dish?
Look at the last one? You look at hen and egg?
Just we'll check out the last dish here that we made for you. We call it the hen and the egg. We were at this farm where...
It's one.
The chickens, they just lived so great, and the eggs were incredible. And we were thinking to ourselves, well, how does a chicken live? And, it sleeps in the house, surrounded by hay. It lays its eggs in hay. And then it walks around in these greens and eats the seeds of all the flowers and so on. So we thought, well, let's just use that as our inspiration. The weeds and the flowers, the hay and the egg. Now, since we become quite, let's say, this is wood sorrel, for instance, since we have become known, you know, there is still a lot of people that somehow enter a restaurant with a bit of anxiety. So we wanted to incorporate humor into this dish to show the guests that we are on their side, that we want them to relax and, you know, smile, have a good time. So we put a 320 degree Celsius warm pan onto wet hay. The guests, they do the dish themselves. They get the kit that you just saw with the timer and everything. You should imagine that you're the guest right now. There's instructions and they're cooking it. And this warm hay just releases, or sorry, the wet hay with the warm pan just releases hay scents. And we have a hay oil to the pan, we crack the egg, we saute the bitter greens, and then we just sprinkle with it. And we do a sauce of all these greens that we find, and that's it. Somehow you become a chicken. All right, that's the last one.
That's beautiful. While we're waiting for the first question, I want to say that Rene will be signing his very, very beautiful book after this. The book is extraordinary.
America's gotten so foodie, especially in New York and on the coasts. And my question to you chefs is, how does this get sort of transmuted into the mainstream? What does fast food look like in 10, 15 years?
Everybody's eating pork buns, of course. You want to take that, Chang?
I mean, I've always maintained, but I think that a lot of the stuff that Rene's doing and other chefs in Europe, maybe like Andoni at Mugri, it's a lot of these guys that are, you know, interpreting their terroir. I think we're going to see a trickle-down effect in America just because it's very contemporary, it's modern, but it's not rustico. It's not just simple. There's a lot of technique, and I think, you know, if it ever hits TGI Fridays in 10 years, then you know it's hit the mainstream. But
don't you also think that the role of a chef has changed? I mean, you must have seen that, the way that in many cases some chefs have become almost role models that can actually... I mean, look at Jamie Oliver, for instance. The way that they can be a part of changing eating habits very fast, in fact. And I think that chefs of today, the most influential ones, can actually be part of this, can inspire, and can help change how people eat. I really believe it.
Yeah, and I think one of the most, for me, fascinating things that's happened in food is that chefs really understand now that so many of the world's problems have to do with food and that it's part of their responsibility to try and make things better. I would say another answer to this question is one of the interesting things that's happening in food now is very much like what's happened in fashion. Food used to go from the top down, and now a lot of it is coming from the bottom up. I mean, the street food, which is coming into restaurants. And so you're seeing a real sort of changing American palate as street food trickles up. So you have it coming from both directions, which is really interesting.
Yep.
How you doing, chefs? Quick question. If I don't work for Momofuku, how can I stage in Noma? I work under Chef Ed Conner at Plain Suit right now, and I'm also staging at Restaurant Danielle's. So I wanted to know if it's possible next summer. I can do 9 months.
How can we say no? Of course.
Who do I need to
We'll talk afterwards.
Sounds good, chef. Thank you.
Thank you.
The most public job application in history.
Uh, Anybody else? Yeah?
So I've heard that David has said in the past that he's not so sure about when the best time it is to, if one's cooking improves as one has children and a wife or a family, and I wonder if you have any feelings about that, since having a child has changed the way you cook, if it's improved or not improved.
My life has improved, of course. I would say that one thing that has changed, actually, is... I'm not saying this because at all I'm opposed to it. It's just, you know, my personal thing was when I had my daughter, she's 2.5 now, you know, once in a while, as a chef, you get these miracle powders that just can help you or transform textures and ingredients in a way that just is so incredibly helpful. But because we're you know, we're not chemists or so on. I don't know what they consist of. You know, I just know it's a chemical. So. Since I've had a baby, if I get another miracle, wonderful chemical that can make my life so good, I have new issues because I've always then I ask myself, would I cook with this? Would I cook my carrot with this, and then give it to my daughter, or would I give my daughter the carrot that's grown by the most passionate people in the best and the most rich soil from the best seed taken at the best possible time of the year and just serve her that? And that, of course, it's very easy to choose, right? So that, it's done that for my kitchen. Do you have children, Chef?
They're chef.
Anybody else? No?
I'll ask a question. A dearth of question, please don't be so shy. We called the program tonight Eating Culture. And when we prepared it, we were intrigued by this notion of a certain form of cultural cannibalism. I'd love you to comment on that.
I go first?
That's all you, Sean. That's all you.
Oh. Cultural cannibalism. What were we talking about when we said that?
We were talking about this sort of national identity on a plate.
Yeah.
And how what we expect now, and one of the things that you've been doing so much when you're doing this whole idea of local food, is that we think we're ingesting our culture when we're eating. And it's a notion that we think about more and more these days. I mean, as we've been thinking about, you know, eating locally and, you know, what does it mean? Mm-hmm. You know, what does it mean to eat Nordic food? What does it mean? I mean, you had this whole idea of, like, you know, trying to think about what New York cuisine might be.
Yeah. But that's true. And it's a very difficult question, actually. And I would say the most difficult part at Noma, since we opened, was actually how that you defined your region and all these ingredients. How did you transcend these onto a plate so that they felt like they belonged only here? Because the notion and the idea of being local is easy to say and easy to implement somehow. You know, I use the example of a crème brûlée. You can make a crème brûlée and put huckleberries in, but the culture of the dish is still a crème brûlée. It still belongs somewhere else. It doesn't become a New York dish or an American dish because the huckleberries are in it. And that has been a big challenge at Restaurant Noma as well, that the food in itself tastes of belonging there without reference points.
But you're so strict on that, though. Like, no black pepper, because it doesn't exist in
yeah. naturally. And
but that's a starting point, perhaps. That was necessary for us. That was necessary for me to have a strong frame of work, and so that I, you know, I didn't fall into some traps. And you know, in the height of winter, you didn't just put in a mango because it was easy. You had to dig deep and really investigate. And besides that, of course, it's, I mean, in our work at Normal, we haven't just investigated all recipe books or always ingredient. We also read about our own culture and tried to understand it. And we read about religion, how religion has had a huge impact on why we don't have a big gastronomical high culture in Denmark and so on. All these elements were important somehow to reach where we are today.
I mean, it's a big burden for food because, I mean, when you think about what politicians do and they go around and, you know, here in this country, you know, they'll go and eat a Katz's pastrami sandwich and that says, you know, I love the Jews. And then they'll go eat a piece of pizza that's like, I love the Italians. And they'll go up and eat, you know, fried chicken in Harlem and with waffles and that's, you know, oh, I love black people. And if we're going to redefine what the national cuisine is. And we do. I mean, we do have this notion of eating our heritage. And now you're redefining the idea of what it is, what your heritage actually is. It's a really interesting question, you know, yeah. Like it changes the whole cuisine.
But it's a question I don't think people are asking themselves, or chefs or restaurateurs or cooks. Particularly in America, you know, and I think that New York should be, I mean, it's not, everyone says it's a culinary capital of the world, but, you know, we're just a regular city. I don't think we have our own cuisine. So it would be very nice to see more restaurants trying to have their own independent vision, trying to figure out what it is that they want to cook, not just more of the same stuff. And I think all of us moved to New York so we could be in the city. And that's something we're struggling with. And that's how I think how this conversation and this question arose when we're trying to talk about this talk. So it's something that it's so difficult that I can't figure it out. And we're just trying to figure out a better way and trying to find an identity. So, you know. Fortunately, Renee's found his, I think. But as a city, New Yorkers and the chefs, we have to find some more individual thinking and some creativity in that.
I would say that, of course, it's also very important to say that our what we do at Noma is not the absolute truth on how something Nordic should be on a plate. You know, it's our idea of it. And I think the way it can truly only become strong and perhaps, if we're lucky, become a gastronomical term, like you see the Italian cuisine or the Mediterranean cuisine, is if there is people that are having their own strong version of what their region is onto a plate by understanding all the culture and all the diversity of ingredients. And by that, perhaps one day, perhaps, you can go to Scandinavia and you can see regional differences, but we all fit in something common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With the growing popularity of foraging, is it sustainable?
Well, I can't say for here. I think it's absolutely no problem. That's what I truly believe. There's so much out there. Of course, you can't just, release an army of chefs in the forest without a type of knowledge on how do you actually harvest and how do you preserve and what do you do so that it's still there next year. There needs to be knowledge in this as well. And do they do the same thing here in America? When you fish, you have to get a card, you know, you have to, a license to fish.
A license, you know, to forage.
Why not? I mean.
Here's your little plot. You have it for a week. Okay.
Is that it?
I think that's it.
One more?
first wanted to say that last night I read pretty much the whole book, and thank you for that. It finally replaced The French Laundry as the most influential book in my life. Second, as a chef, what is your last meal on Earth, and who would you eat it with?
My last meal on Earth, it would, of course, be with my family, my daughter and my wife, and it would probably be a bowl of blueberries with cream.
I think on that note, or David, do you have a last meal?
No comment. I have
no idea. With no comment in mind, thank you very much to René Redzepi, Ruth Reichel, and David Chang.